from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next on Forum, neurologist and novelist Robert Burton warns us not to get too excited about the groundbreaking discoveries about the brain. In his new book, A Skeptic's Guide to the Mind, What Neuroscience Can and Cannot Tell Us About Ourselves, he takes on the topic of the limits of neuroscience, and he'll join us here in studio for the hour after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's second hour of the Forum program. We're joined this hour by Robert Burton, MD, a San Franciscan who served as chief of neurology at Mount Zion UCSF Hospital and associate chief of the Division of Neurosciences. He's also a novelist and the author of On Being Certain, Believing You Are Right Even When You're Not. We talked about that with him on Forum. He also has published work in Salon, the San Francisco Chronicle, and now writes for a new science and philosophy site and magazine called Nautilus, and recently published a book called A Skeptic's Guide to the Mind, What Neuroscience Can and Cannot Tell Us About Ourselves. Joins us in studio, and Bob Burton, good to have you back with us on Forum. Welcome.
Hi, Michael. It's my pleasure.
Well, you know, all this brain scan stuff, I mean, I welcome this book, I must tell you, because we're still in really early, forgive me for putting it this way, embryonic stages, and yet we have neuroscientists who are using imaging and coming to all kinds of conclusions. And that's kind of your polemic here, isn't it, that the conclusions are premature?
You use the word embryonic. I'd say preconception.
All right. It's a lot of it's just interpretive and subjective, you say,
correct.
Really. Yeah. And that's the problem. I mean, that is a problem, isn't it?
Well, you know, the problem is neuroscience is science. Science is the language of synapses and neurotransmitters. In order to be able to discuss what it means, you have to use the language of science and philosophy, common sense and pop culture, et cetera. And it's in the translation that the problems arise.
I don't know how many listeners heard an interview I did yesterday with Helen Fisher. It was at the North Theater, and it was part of City Arts and Lectures, and was presented, in fact, by the California Academy of Sciences. And she's done all these studies of, you know, neurons and hooking people up and discovering what makes romance and attraction and love and lust and so forth. And I thought, man, I couldn't help asking about the magic and the mystery. I mean, it's sort of absent from a lot of that, isn't it?
Well, you know, it's interesting. You do these scans. There's no lust in your brain. And there's not a single neuron that craves a 22-year-old. It's you that craves the 22-year-old. So when you use the words lust and romance, those are words that come out of our understanding of literature and philosophy and just what we are as human beings. Those aren't scientific terms.
But you have all the scientific data. I mean, that's sort of what's going on. You have the scientific data that seems to at least explain the mind to us. But a lot of what it's doing is, and I think you use this language, don't you? Pure storytelling.
That's right. Well, it explains the brain. And let's face it, I'm not against science. Science is the only way you can understand the facts of the world. So I don't in any way.
Well, you're a scientist. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't mean to denigrate in any way scientific method. But scientific method is about objectivity. And there's no way to reproduce lust. I mean, we wish there was. I mean, wouldn't it be great if you could reproduce lust at will? But the fact of the matter is it's not an objective in the laboratory thing to study.
Reminded of Adrian Rich, who said, lust too is a jewel. But you want to bring unconscious intention into all this data as much as we can determine what unconscious intention is, yeah?
Right. Well, you know, one of the problems is that every study that is done presently or will be done in the foreseeable future captures this moment in time. It doesn't capture a person's history. So, for example, if I met you 20 years ago, which I did, and let's say we had a beef, which we didn't, but let's just say we had a beef and I forgot about it, that beef will still be recorded somewhere in my brain, but it will not be recorded in a manner that I can now detect it because I can't tell you about it if I can't recall the memory. So your past is strewn with
with all kinds of beef?
No. With all kinds of experience that cannot be seen on the scans of today. Now, in order to really have a scanner, you'd have to have a scan for all of times with perfect recall by the person and perfect translation of that into language that we would all agree upon. But even if we had perfect language, your pain, if you stub your toe, isn't exactly the same pain I have. Is it the problem of, is your red the same as my red? I mean, so there are a lot of things from the whether you can study a person over a lifetime all the way up to how you describe it if you know, in accurate terms that limit what we can say about the mind, not the brain. We can say plenty about the brain, and we will eventually uncover most of the brain.
Wasn't this part of the problem, linking brain and mind and linking them to consciousness too?
Correct.
So, well, also the contradictoriness of what we talk about as mind is essentially enigmatic. I mean, you talk about the subconscious brain, but I keep thinking about, I used Adrian Rich, I fall back on poets for lack of
art. Right.
I think of Whitman, you know, do I contradict myself? Oh, I contradict myself. I'm large. I contain multitudes.
Right.
And the brain is constantly contradicting, and so is the mind.
Well, we don't really know what a mind is because mind really exists in two dimensions, as I sort of describe in the book, is you have the experience of a mind. So first of all, I feel that I'm right behind my forehead talking to you, and you probably feel like you're just behind your forehead talking to me. But that is a sensation created by your brain. And everybody is aware of out-of-body experiences, but I don't think most people realize you can create those simply by stimulating the brain in certain ways. And they've done it to the point now where by altering your visual input of where I think I'm seeing the world from, I can project your image onto a mannequin, your self-image, and then when you go and try and stab the mannequin, you or heart rate will speed up and you'll feel anxious. In other words, your very sense of self, the core structure upon which you hang all your memories and beliefs and stories you tell about yourself, is a sensation your brain creates.
But so, neuroscience is supposed to tell us about things like out-of-body experiences, isn't it?
It does.
Yeah.
It does, and then we create the stories about what that means.
And the same can be held true for other ways that neuroscience is being applied, like body image disorders or advertising.
Correct.
Or, you know, it's go on and on ad infinitum.
Well, you know, I just read last week, for example, that we think of anorexia and we think of all the various psychological possible causes for anorexia. But they did a study recently that irrespective of the initial cause, it eventually becomes a body schema map disorder. And if you and I walk through a doorway, you will turn sideways when the doorway is maybe 25% wider than you because you know you might hit it otherwise. Anorexics turn when it's 50% wider. In other words, they actually see themselves bigger than they were. So I talked about this with a lady who runs a bariatric surgery service. She says, you can get rid of the weight. You cannot get rid, change the body image.
Talking with Robert Burton, and his new book is A Skeptic's Guide to the Mind, What Neuroscience Can and Cannot Tell Us About Ourselves. And we tend to think now. I remember, you know, interviewing Francis Crick years ago. He had this book out saying we're all neurons, really, and all these neural connections and all this going into the sense of how they all work, whether 86 billion neurons and 110 trillion connections and so forth. So mapping all these, and President Obama has set out this mapping project, I mean, is supposed to answer what mind is, isn't it?
That's the theory. But if you think about it, suppose you have a perfect map. How do you know what that map stands for? It's like having an unlabeled map of an unknown country. Someone's got to tell you what each of those things stands for. So in other words, there isn't any thought. There's no message. There's no...
Or maybe another planet.
Yes, exactly. But there's no message like in a fortune cookie inside each neuron that you can look at it and know what it stands for. You have to talk to the person.
Talk about something else that you write about in your new book, group mind influences. I mean, you talk about ants and termites and slime mold
right.
and locusts and everything. What are we speaking of here in terms of neuroscience with group mind?
Well, the thing that's fascinated me is that we have a bunch of sort of involuntary sensations which create a sense of self. They also create a sense of agency, and they create a sense that we're unique. In other words, if you feel you're bounded by your body image and you have a moat between you and people around you, in other words, so your so-called interpersonal space, collectively, that's you. You're separate from the rest of the world. And at the same token, if you have feelings of ownership, like of your body parts, you have a sense of ownership of your ideas, collectively we feel that we're unique. I mean, this is unfortunately one of the problems with existentialism. You feel like you're separate from the rest of the world.
And I think, as you say in your book, agency is what gives us the idea that there's this constant, battle going on, so to speak, between free will and determinism.
Correct. Yeah. It may well generate the ideas. We may not even think about the idea of free will if we didn't have the sense of agency. But anyhow, one of these organisms that fascinated me is the locust, because the locust exists in two forms. It exists as a solitary little locust that sits by itself. It's a vegetarian. It doesn't associate with other people. And then when the rains come, like in Africa, they breed like crazy. Then the rains go away after a few days. Now there are a bunch of them, and there's no water. And then they start what they call swarming behavior, which we're all aware of. But until 10 years ago, it was thought that a swarming locust was completely different than a solitary locust. Now they find out that there are little hairs on the back of the locust, and you stroke it, and it secretes serotonin. And that causes the swarming behavior. But what's interesting to me is the brain changes. I mean, it actually, the visual cortex reorganizes so that it adjusts from the visual cortex optimized for solitary hunting for food into group hunting for food. The muscles in the body change. The color changes. And I'm sure you've been at in a symphony in a large auditorium when it's really crowded, and you, when you're on the way out, you make these little tiny movements of with your legs. You say, I don't want to run into the guy in front of me. And so we say, I'm doing this. But those are the exact same motions that the locusts do when they start to swarm. They first, when you get them to a certain critical mass, they start marching in place. And I thought, how would we know the difference? So if you think about taking studies now on empathy and altruism and so on, and you put people by themselves in an fMRI scanner, you're missing whatever contribution there would be from a group behavior or a group mind, because you can't see it. And so whether or not how important this is in real life, I don't know. But to take these involuntary sensations of a personal bounded self and extrapolating, that's all there is, which is when people say the mind is the brain, eliminates all the other things we see in the natural world as other possibilities for a more extended mind.
Also goes to an example you use of someone, let's say, who has what is described often as a vegetative mind, right?
Right.
And what we can determine or what we can actually scientifically measure?
Correct. Well, you know, at the time that On Being Certain came out, exactly about that time, there was a study from England in which a young woman who'd been in a car accident, who'd been left devastated, multiple brain surgeries, lots of areas of her brain had been destroyed. She was basically in what they call a vegetative state. But they did an extremely clever and technologically shrewd study in which they put headphones on the woman, put her inside an fMRI scanner, and asked her to, number one, imagine walking around her house, and number two, playing tennis. And she'd been an avid tennis player before. And then they compared her with matched controls in terms of what her fMRI showed, and it showed the same thing. So if I said, imagine yourself hitting a backhand, the same area lit up. So they concluded that she was conscious and alert and fully aware of herself. But, you know, this goes back to the whole problem of what is consciousness. First of all, consciousness includes a lot of states from delirium and hallucinations and nightmares to fully aware and alert and so on. But even so, it also goes to the question of awareness. But the real question is, we don't know what the unconscious brain does. We have always thought at first that we're completely irrational since the Enlightenment days anyhow. That then you got Freud and so on. And the 20th century was, as you know, started with Joyce and Wolf, you know, in the stream of consciousness. And gradually we're understanding that a greater percentage of our thoughts are unconscious. Now the question might arise, what if any of our thoughts are conscious?
And neuroscience may be trying, through all this fMRI, trying to substitute serotonin and these other hormones for what we used to think of as the diagrammatic sense of ego, id, and all that.
It's the next generation. And actually, one of the concerns I have is that you've seen what's happened to psychiatry. I mean, there are really good aspects of psychiatry, but it's taken a huge hit because it's promised more than it could deliver and gave some theories that were not scientific. But if the psychiatrist had said to you, I really don't know what to say about your condition, but in my experience, this has helped the following treatments, that would be a lot better than saying that you have X, Y, or Z, like, or you've caused your child schizophrenia, like in the so-called schizophrenogenic mother. It's some sort of honesty and some modest statement of what we know is a lot better than the overblown statements that, that depression is a disorder of serotonin metabolism.
And also, your example of schizophrenia puts to my mind, you know, all of the mothers who suffered because, not thinking that it was linked to their schizophrenia and their children were linked specifically to them, but all the autism, you know, thanks to Bettelheim, that
that's
was assumed to be because of the mother and all of that.
Well, you know, it's whenever that's, and so that's the importance of labeling something a theory versus a fact. If you can say my theory is that autism is caused by, then the person you're telling it to at least has the opportunity to say I accept or I don't accept that. But if you say science has proven that autism is due to X, Y, Z, then the person who's a layperson has no real say in the matter. And really, all of these things are should be a interaction between the physician and the patient.
Talking again with Dr. Robert Burton, self-proclaimed skeptic and a man who is very much in favor of uncertainty and question asking. And his book is A Skeptic's Guide to the Mind, What Neuroscience Can and Cannot Tell Us About Ourselves. You may have something you want to tell us about this. In fact, you may want to join the conversation, and I'd like to invite you now to do that. We welcome your involvement, and if you have questions or comments, join us now. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. Again, the number for your questions or comments, and for you to join the conversation is 866-733-6786, and there are a number of other ways that you can become a part of this conversation. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments immediately right onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or go to our Facebook page or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, and Bob Burton will be at Copperfields in Sebastopol, 7 o'clock, to discuss his book, Skeptic's Guide to the Mind, but now he's discussing it with us. And so what does neuroscience really tell us about things like empathy, which it makes good claims for, at least being revelatory about?
I'm not sure. In other words, this is, gets back to the reason I even wrote a chapter in a book on altruism in which there were loads of articles on empathy, and I tried to read them, but I really couldn't come to grips with it because empathy is a feeling state which you, and it obviously originates in the brain in some manner, but the real question arises, can you learn it, or is this an innate trait? And I'm not sure I can give you an answer to that because the more I read about it, the more confused I become. I don't really know that anything from a scan or from electrical recordings from individual neurons can tell you about what a person's experiencing. So we're still left by talking to people.
So if there's a kind of agenda, which I think you imply behind a lot of this research, where can it actually lead us vis-a-vis enlightenment or real illumination?
I think that ultimately, as we go forward, we're going to learn more and more about how the brain creates aspects of personality. In other words, probably the best studies in my mind in some sort of simplistic way is the identical twins raised apart. And you find out that they have a lot of traits in common and that you get some idea of the percentages of contribution of genes, let's say, to personality. And then as you go forward, we will get scans that show that people who have repetitive bouts of violent behavior have certain abnormalities and scans in certain regions. So eventually we will have additional data upon which to judge a person's behavior. But ultimately what we need is some theory of personal responsibility and the contribution between conscious and unconscious thought, neither of which we presently really have a good idea.
So as you say, we're still in a preconception stage, but you also kind of somewhat polemically say we're using our minds to study our minds, and we don't know what the minds are.
That's right. I mean, you know, we think that's from Aristotle onward. People have speculated what the mind is. If you take the locust example, which is why I mentioned it, what would you call the mind? Obviously, the locust individually is having chemical changes that change his brain, but it's created by a group phenomena.
Ants doing that.
Yeah,
work.
But it's also maybe like the Nuremberg rallies. I mean, it's really hard to know the difference, but I don't know how you'd study a Nuremberg rally. You couldn't put the people in scans. You couldn't put them all in EEGs. And yet you see a behavior. I mean, there are a lot of articles that are written about how—
mass behavior. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and I mean, isn't that a—I mean, when you listen to Rush Limbaugh, if you have to, I mean, you go, how is this affecting the individual mind? But we don't—you can't get there by studying the individual brain. except as the final pathway for what might be a group phenomenon.
Or for that matter, how is advertising affecting the brain?
Right.
You know, it almost presents an impossible study. I like a quote of yours, which I'm going to throw out to listeners here. Wisdom is humility in the face of mystery. That's one to covet. But the idea that there's an absolutist way of assessing the mind when, again, your major theme, uncertainty, error, the right. unconscious, the imperceptible.
Right.
How can we come to these kind of conclusions? And yet, that's what we do. So all this functional magnetic resonance imaging, which is being used for market research and media creation and so forth, apparently it does have some values to those who are employing it or deploying it.
I mean, we have focus groups that decide why people like Coke or Pepsi. Now, if you put them in a scanner, you'll find certain areas of the brain light up. If that's additional information, it's of a quasi-value, right? I'm not really sure what it – because a lot of these things – for example, they did a study on five-month-old babies recently that showed that they could find that they're both conscious and had memories. Well, you know that if you look at a five-month-old baby. I mean – on the other hand, it's an additional piece of information that is you, so that we'll be able to give it more scientific terminology, but it doesn't give you some fundamental new insight. On the other hand, the fact that you see certain areas of the brain are damaged in people with recurrent psychopathic behavior, that does give you additional information. So on some are of great value, others are frivolous, and it's hard often to sort them out.
Well, I was reading some letters in the New York Times about the new book that's out by Daniel Begrin, all about, you know, how women and men are more alike sexually than we've often thought or posited. And you were talking about lust before, and he says, you know, that women are far more lustful than is imagined or has been conceived, forgive the choice of words. And what they do is they hook, or he did in this study, and a number of other scientists hooked these women up and showed them pictures of men aroused and this sort of thing and said, you know, does this get you aroused? And they said, no. And in many instances, there was a registering, neural registering that was far different than what they were saying. So that seems to me to be at least a portal where this kind of work can be helpful and enlightening.
Oh, I think that as we get more information, we will be able to see that brains reflect parent states that we aren't consciously aware of. But this gets to be the problem of, like, for example, they think that they have found, at least to some extent, the signal for pain. But if a patient doesn't say they have pain or a person's not aware of pain, that puts the whole question, what do you mean by pain? In other words, if you see the same, and this is being done more and more, where you get a pattern, you say, the pain matrix is increased. And then you draw a conclusion from it. Now, for example, you may draw a conclusion that the person's experiencing pain but doesn't feel it. Well, I don't know what that means. I mean, this is where you need some clarification what you're talking about.
Again, our guest is Dr. Robert Burton. He's a San Franciscan and the author of a new book called A Skeptic's Guide to the Mind, What Neuroscience Can and Cannot Tell Us About Ourselves. He's former chief of the Department of Neurology at Mount Zion UCSF Hospital and writes for a new science and philosophy site and magazine called Nautilus. And when we return, we'll get you involved in this. I also have a vital question I have to ask you, Bob, when we return. But in the meantime, there are ways that you can participate. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Or email us, forum at kqed.org, or tweet us, our Twitter handle, at kqedforum, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and we'll click on this segment. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, neurologist and novelist. Robert Burton, MD, warns us not to get too excited about groundbreaking discoveries about the brain. In his new book, A Skeptic's Guide to the Mind, What Neuroscience Can and Cannot Tell Us About Ourselves, he urges readers to think more critically about neuroscience research and asks whether we can truly define the mind with any certainty. And again, Bob Burton will be at Coppersfield in Sebastopol at 7 o'clock to discuss his book, A Skeptic's Guide to the Mind. And he says that, and I should mention again that he's a novelist because looking at a quote of yours where you say, the texture of consciousness is the language of literature, not the data of science. And I say here as a literary guy. But I said I wanted to ask you a vital question that continues to kind of haunt my consciousness before we get our listeners involved in this. And that is, you see, you know, young people now, and not only young people, but people of our generation, older, looking at their iPhones, looking, you know, texting, doing all this all the time. Is this changing neural pathways, especially in the young who are literally growing up on these kinds of things?
Without doubt. As far as I can say that for, some, with, for someone who's...
for someone who's certain about everything, or uncertain about everything. Yeah. So what does that mean, though?
You know, in the book I mentioned about this little diagram, the Mueller-Lyer illusion, in which, since you can't see it on the radio, it's basically two lines in which the arrows make it look like one line is longer than the other. And what they've shown is that in Western cultures and the higher degree of technology, the greater the discrepancy between the way we see the two arrows, and we see about a 20 to 25% one where the ends of the arrows are going in one direction, this being 20, 25% longer than the ones that are going in the other direction. People in primitive cultures see them exactly the same. The conclusion of the psychologist, who's Dr. Heinrich from Vancouver, is that culture even determines your perceptions. So it actually shapes the way your mind sees something as simple as the length of two lines. Now, if this is the case, and you now, and we talk about an extended mind with your PDAs and smartphones and this and that and the other thing, we download what we once thought of as being a smart person. Like in neurology, one of the things was if you had a great memory, you were thought to be smart. Nowadays, you just carry the thing along with you. You're a different person. You don't even need that. So I think, yes, it does shape your...
Google's making us stupid. There was a book by that title, Making Us Stupider.
Heard someone yesterday say to me, there is so much information, I'm having trouble keeping up with reality. And I thought, what does he mean by reality? Is it information? That's what has come to be. So, yes, we are changing.
Let's get our callers in, and we go first to Don. Don, you're on.
Hi.
Hi.
My question is this. What is the nature of conceptual thought before you put it into language? I speak German poorly, but when I'm speaking to a German, I'm thinking in German, and my concepts are coming out in German. If I'm thinking in English, my concepts will come out in English. But before it gets put into language, the concepts are in my mind, especially true of mathematics. So what is the nature of this conceptual thinking before language?
No one has a clue. So Steven Pinker refers to it as mental ease, which doesn't really help. I mean, if you think of your brain as in part a computational device of some sort, obviously you have pluses and minuses, whether those are neurotransmitters, excitatory, inhibitory, whether it's up or down, gene regulation. Collectively, they are doing some sort of calculation. How it's translated into language is probably as difficult a question as how does that go into consciousness and how do we experience it? I mean, you get the Nobel Prize if you even come up with an idea you can suggest.
Get to work, Don.
I've been wondering about this for a long time.
Yeah, I have no idea.
Thank you for the call. Let me get another caller on here, and that's you, Alex. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just had a comment. My brother was diagnosed paranoid schizophrenic in 2005, and I do believe in schizophrenia, and I do believe in the treatment for it and stuff, but I kind of don't like the way our culture handles it, and in the way of he did have, you know, issues growing up and was kind of a on-the-defense kind of a fighting kid. But then I think the diagnosis and the way society kind of handled them probably made it worse. And I think it's a little pretentious and kind of obnoxious the way people go around just kind of diagnosing such life-changing things like that. You know, there maybe needs to be a different process to it. I just wanted to hear your thoughts on that. I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thank you for the question, Alex.
What you're really asking in a way is the language of disease. In other words, how you frame a person's condition definitely affects how they feel about their condition. And that's very difficult. Now, for example, as schizophrenia is studied more and more, I think we'll find more and more that it's a disease of the brain.
Well, there are new theories linking it to bacteria, for example.
Yeah, and inflammation of some sort.
Inflammations, so, yeah. Right, yeah.
So if you were, in all fairness to your brother, what you have to say is he has a disease that we don't yet understand. And we can call it schizophrenia because that's the history behind it. It doesn't mean that schizophrenia is a single illness or that we know the cause. unfortunately, that's not the way we can communicate greater sense. We have to have a language that everybody seems to understand and that doesn't allow for sort of vague definitions. So we use schizophrenia like it's one disease, but in fact...
There are four types of schizophrenia. I mean, hyperphrenic and paranoid and catatonic and simple. But also, this goes back to language in another way. Schizophrenia was originally called dementia praecox, which means splitting of the personality. And it's more of a dissociation and a psychosis than... I mean, people will use the word freely. They've used it on the air here with me. They say, I'm schizophrenic about something, meaning I'm divided. And that's incorrect. Just simply incorrect.
Well, see, what you just said was actually the whole dispute between the DSM-5 and with the National Institutes of Mental Health said, and what really what it is the clinical symptoms, hyperphrenia, catatonia, don't map well onto a specific biological substrate. And the problem is we don't know how the biologic substrate creates these different conditions. And so naturally, his brother's going to get different explanations and feelings about it depending on who he talks to, because those are different levels of explanation.
Again, beware certainty. Let me go to another caller. Peter, you're on. Hi.
Hi, Dr. Burton. Thank you for the provocative ideas. My question relates to a book called How to Write When You Sleep. And this book sold particularly well in Marin County, California. And I'm wondering if it tells us more about the reading habits of Marin County than it does about the subconscious.
You have truly got me. I live in Marin County, and I don't actually know what goes on when you sleep. But obviously, they now have some evidence, for example, that people can even count in their sleep, that they can actually do addition and subtraction without even being aware they're doing it. So as we uncover more about the unconscious, we may be able to find that you're writing stories. I mean, that's what dreams are. Dreams are fragmented stories.
In fact, I was just thinking about Yeats and Lady Gregory and all that automatic writing. I mean, they really were strong believers that something could...
Madame Lebowski.
Madame Blavatsky, exactly. You know, there's something that could come out of your unconscious. And supposedly that's what's going on when you're dreaming. Although, a lot of new research about dreaming out of Harvard particularly, it suggests that maybe Freud was dead wrong. It's not the royal road to the unconscious. It's just kind of a lot of neurons releasing whatever they release.
Well, a lot of people think that it's the sunset scavenger coming to take away the events of the day.
Yeah, or whatever. The everyday residue is what Freud called it. Here's Frieda from Berkeley who writes, in contrast to studying vaguer phenomena such as desire and empathy, what about diseases like Parkinson's where there is a scientific concrete cause, lack of dopamine? How much can neuroscience say and predict about that? And how about the type of prediction you hear so often in 10 years a cure will be found?
Neuroscience about the brain is the only way to understand diseases that occur in the brain. So for a disease like Parkinsonism, in which you're using the behavioral manifestations when you look at the patient, you see they have a tremor, difficulty with walking, that is in the realm of science. I'm hopeful they'll find answers to these things. But I mean, I've been around for 40 years, and we found L-DOPA was discovered in the late 60s. And now we have deep brain stimulation. But we're still a long ways from understanding how to cure it. But I'm hopeful that in somebody's lifetime, not probably in mine, we'll find those answers.
Here's another listener, Sophia, who writes, can you ask Dr. Burton what he thinks about the theory of mirror neurons as the basis of empathy?
Since this is just an hour program, let me say that Scientific American excerpted the entire chapter I have on mirror neurons, and you can get it without buying the book.
And it's online.
Yeah, it's online on Scientific American about a couple of weeks ago.
I haven't read it, so tell us, is there some validity to the whole idea? Or what is mirror neurons exactly?
Well, if you think about this, when we learn anything, we learn first by observing and then by carrying out the action. When I learn to play the piano, first you watch your teacher do it and then you do it. Okay. So there has to be a connection between learning through observation and the actual carrying out of the act.
And that's mirroring behavior.
So when you find mirror neurons in certain areas of the brain, yes, the brain's going to have circuits for learning and carrying out the activity. I mean, that seems to be self-evident, but it's nice to have it confirmed neurophysiologically. But it's a long step from there to saying that's the origin of empathy or what makes us human in some sense, because you can have learning without any empathy. Empathy is a separate category of condition. Empathy is an emotional state unrelated. You may or may not have it. So I have a very strong criticism about mirror neurons as the relationship of as the sole cause of empathy, although it might be a contributor.
Here's a guy from Oakland, Bill, who says, not one of us on this earth got a chance to choose the mind we're born with, whether it's intellectual brain, analytical mind, bipolar mind, autistic mind, or criminal mind. Yet we choose to punish people born with criminal minds, but not other pathologies.
That's correct. In other words, we really don't have a very good conception of personal responsibility, partly because we've always attributed personal responsibility to whatever we do consciously. He consciously intended to shoot that man, therefore he's...
Motive.
Yes. So motives are basically what people can dredge up from their unconscious, in which we have very poor access to how we actually think, because we can't see our genes in action, we can't see our early development, we can't remember our early memories. So we have very poor facility for introspection, and yet we also attribute everything at the same time to whatever we consciously can decide is our motivation. So until such time as we have a better concept of personal responsibility, we're going to blame people falsely for a lot of things that are beyond their control. I remember when I was a kid, people had tics where their parents were blamed and told, they kept saying the kids stopped that. Now you find it's Tourette syndrome. I mean, it's just a simple example.
Now, you're getting a lot of questions about body and mind, where they are together or where they need to be separate and all that. In fact, Michael writes on our Facebook page, in Raja Yoga, we separate brain and mind. The mind can be divided into several parts. One is spoken of as the overmind or superconsciousness. That sounds like Emerson again. It's the goal of meditation to elevate ourself from its connection to the physical and to be elevated to the divine. I mean, talk a little bit about where you separate brain and mind.
Well, we experience a mind, and the experience of mind generates what we think about the concept of a mind, and we're limited by how strongly we feel that we are contained within ourselves, or conversely, as this caller mentioned, part of a larger cosmic universe. And if you think about it from a biologic standpoint, the greater your sense of personal self and personal boundaries and sense of agency, probably the less you're going to feel part of the general universe. You're going to feel, you know, constrained. On the other hand, if you don't have those feelings to the same degree, for whether you don't have them because biologically you weren't born that way or because you weren't taught that way, you have a greater chance of seeing the world in a more cosmic dimension. And actually one of my concerns about science is that it tries to restrict your understanding of yourself to the scientific dimension. Now, I don't have that cosmic dimension. I'd love to have it, but it isn't part of my personality.
You're like me. You have envy maybe even for those who have cosmic consciousness.
That's right.
But in fact, Roger asks, is there a part of the brain associated with soul or spirit, or for that matter, cosmic consciousness?
If you ask me is there part of the mind, I'd say it depends whether or not you have an extended mind. If you ask about the brain, I mean, we don't believe there's a soul per se. I mean, soul is a wonderful word to describe some intangible essence that we attribute to a person, which may not actually be a physiologic phenomenon.
Let me bring another caller aboard here, and we'll go to you, Marcia, next. Hi, welcome.
Hi, I have a question about the placebo effect and what actually happens in the mind, and why is it that we can't all tune into it to get, you know, a more positive outcome, and why is it that when they do drug trials, they always, I don't really understand what it is, and they say one person is on the drug and the other person isn't, and, the placebo, so I just don't understand that.
Placebo effect is very powerful, and no one knows for sure how it works, but it probably works or at least in part by elevating in personal levels of endorphins and activating the reward system in a way where you have your pain is sufficiently decreased or your symptoms are decreased. It is powerful and variable amongst people. It's probably the most single useful remedy in modern medicine other than the handful of drugs we have. But how you can assign it to any particular person is a guesswork, because you don't know whether or not you're susceptible to placebo.
It used to be like when I was a kid, I would watch these faith healers, and again, there would be people who would be crippled and they would be in wheelchairs, and suddenly, they got Jesus and they just got up out of the wheelchair.
I mean, that's right.
there's a lot to be said for, that's maybe kind of a placebo effect, isn't it?
It's a lot of life is placebo effect. If I come in here today and I say, you're looking great, I mean, that may be a placebo effect.
Oh, you did. You made me feel good when you came in.
But I mean, this is the way we relate with people. But placebo effect is a form of activating those circuits in the brain that give one sense of hope and optimism and pleasure and so on, without which we would be doomed. So the placebo effect really isn't just to medicine. It's modern life.
On we go. Ed, you're with us. Hi, good morning. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. My question for Dr. Burton is this. In our era of pill and bill bureaucratized DSM-dictated psychiatry, I'm wondering what your opinion is of Thomas Szasz, who's the psychiatrist who wrote The Myth of Mental Illness and many other books insisting that psychiatry was entirely or almost entirely scientifically bogus.
And who did not want any psychiatry to be used in the courtroom, for example, famous Twinkies trial and so forth. Yeah.
Again, this gets back to the same problem, is that modern psychology, as we understand it, has its origins in ancient times. So some of the jargon is completely outmoded by modern science. Other parts of it make common sense, but then common sense itself is an intuitive aspect which may not represent real biology. So what you have is layer upon layer of interpretation and storytelling through the generations, of which we accept what we want and don't accept. So there are aspects of psychiatry that are dead wrong, and there are other aspects that are wonderful. There isn't any single – I mean, if I had wanted a soundbite answer, I'd give you one. But the answer is it's much more complicated than that.
Let me thank the caller. And Melanie asks, could you comment on the gut as the second brain? You know, particularly when people say, I feel it in my gut, or police officer says, you know, my gut's telling me that this is – you know.
There's two aspects. In my last book, I described the feeling of knowing is an involuntary sensation that is generated in your brain. It comes along with a feeling in your gut, so to speak. It feels as though the idea is somewhere in your body and it's right. On the other hand, there's also a lot of evidence that there are an enormous number of neural connections within the gut that have some of the same neurotransmitters that you have in the brain. So this is yet to be fully elucidated. I don't really have an answer. It may turn out to be important.
Really, the heart of your book and the argument is there just needs to be more emphasis on unconscious intention in determining some of what the science is leading to. But that in itself is a little bit like dark matter sometimes, isn't it?
Correct. Well, you know, you have to ask yourself, is there any scientific method for determining something that's long past in your own past in the absence of the person having total and accurate recall? And the answer is no. But without that, we're really left trying to figure out what is human motivation over a protracted period of time. In other words, if you decide you want to write a novel, but you put it out of your mind for 10 years, and then you start writing it, you may not know why you're doing it. Then I come on here and you say, why did you write that book? You really don't have an idea. You just come up with an idea, but it may not be the correct one. But if I was in a scanner, what I said at that moment would look like the total picture, but it wouldn't be.
I sometimes find myself, and I'm curious to get your response to this, as one gets older, one finds the synapses aren't necessarily there. You know, you're trying to recall something, and, you know, you could it's just you can't summon certain memories or certain facts or whatever. But sometimes I'm not even sure it's memory loss. Sometimes I think maybe my circuits are just overloaded, as you use that metaphor so often. And it sort of obviates or gets in the way.
And, you know, not all memory loss is bad. I mean, you know, we're born with twice as many neurons as we have in adult life, and the ones that we don't use are pruned. So,
but we're not only losing them as we get older. We're making new ones,
So that's what I was going to say. It's a dynamic process where, on the one hand, if you haven't thought about algebra for 40 years, it makes sense for your brain to make way for something new like, you know, that you're doing now. So, yes, we do generate new neurons, and we also prune away old ones, and the process is ongoing in both directions.
Another listener says, could you please ask Dr. Burton about the God-gene hypothesis? This predisposes humans toward spiritual or mystical experiences. Not sure what that is, but again, it's a question of where our spirituality or our seeking God comes from, and is it neural or is it
in our
brain to begin with, even?
You know, in the last book, I talked about the sense of purpose and meaning, and a good way to think about this is if you've ever been depressed and you say, what's the point? You lose the sense of meaning. On the other hand, when you engage in something you fully like, meaning is present, but it isn't a thought, it's a feeling. So purpose and meaning are feelings. To that extent, I suppose that if you feel a very strong sense of purpose, you may attribute to something. So it's the sense of purpose that you've now labeled. And that would be, some people have a greater or lesser sense of purpose.
Again, Robert Burton's new book is A Skeptic's Guide to the Mind, What Neuroscience Can and Cannot Tell Us About Ourselves. The listener asks, neuroscience is interested in the brain. We can only infer what happens in the mind. Why be skeptical about the mind?
Oh, I'm not skeptical about the mind. I think the mind is fascinating. I mean, that's really most of what we think about every day, whether I try to read someone's mind or try and figure out why somebody said what they do. So it's great fun, and it's great to have as much practical and scientific information as possible, but it still is in the realm of storytelling. So I'm not being skeptical about the mind. I'm being skeptical about a single approach to it. I think that there's science, there's philosophy, there's storytelling, there's music. There are a variety of ways of approaching the mind and from different perspectives.
And we'll bring on some more callers. We go next to Richard in Pengrove. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael. Thank you for the program. Dr. Burton, fascinating discussion. I was hoping that you could comment on some of the practices that have been popular for a long time, but there's also some new ones that reach for they're partnered practices. They're not just individual practices, and sometimes group practices of reaching for being and flow. And this idea of flow being one, and like you made reference to earlier, perhaps a reference to birds. You see a flock of birds, and they're doing that marvelous cloud-like co-creation of a new shape, a new way of moving in each moment, and never touching, never bumping into one another. And in some practices with humans, this is being reached for with connective practices. And could you speak to connection, being, and flow?
You know, I'm not personally familiar with that, but I don't discount it. It's the kind of thing for which I have no knowledge, and therefore I hate to pass some half-wit explanation onto you. But if we do have a group mind, it may well be that there are ways to augment the good aspects of it.
Wonderful. There's a practice in Sebastopol this evening called Flowing Dragon Swords. That's one of the ones.
Cool.
Maybe check it out.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, thanks for that recommendation. It's always, you know, astonishing to me when we think about, group behavior and so forth, or group mind. How is it, you know, that these monarch butterflies and these birds make, the journeys, almost epic journeys that they go on, you know, and what programs them? I mean, the neuroscience of that is incomprehensible, but it's fascinating.
That's correct. In a word, I mean, you know, you watch these slime mold that will seek out food. There's no brain. And yet they have something you have to call group purpose or intention. So what you're left with is a language of intention and purpose without any brain. You go, that's not possible. So I don't know how you'd study that aspect of our behavior.
Listener writes, when I look at brain and mind, I draw a comparison between computer hardware and software. Studying the brain to understand mind seems like opening up the computer to understand why my email is not working. Do we have an understanding of what the software for the brain might be? Is it our DNA or something else?
I have no idea. I have none.
Yeah, you always remind me of my dad used to say, when you don't know, say, I don't know.
That's right.
That was good paternal advice. Here's a listener who says, my questions pertain to memory. Occasionally, my little 2-year-old granddaughter picks up my smartphone. Since she was about 20 months, she's been able to go directly to the icon for my photo memory, then go directly to the videos of her that are stored there. She is fascinated to watch her entire self, and I wonder if these prompts will in the future enhance her actual memory.
I don't know if it'll enhance her memory. It might enhance her cell phone's memory because all of that's stored on the cell phone. So one of the questions that is now arising is, are we basically relying more and more on our extended devices?
The memory of our technology, yeah. Let me get another caller on. And this is Armadine. Hi.
Yes, hello.
Good morning.
Good morning, and a wonderful program. Listen all the time. My question is, what is the neurological influence on, say,
gender identity.
Huge and unknown.
Huge and unknown.
In other words, I even did a piece for Salon years ago and reviewed the data, and obviously it's an enormous subject. There's no question that in a general sense, our biology is dictated both by what we've inherited and experienced. So nature nurtures an old, outmoded concept. So there's no question biology plays a role in gender, and I suppose experience does as well.
And culture.
That's
like
what I mean
before,
by experience. Yeah.
And culture.
Yeah.
So how does this explain like a person who's born with a XY, you know, and knows in my soul that I'm she, female.
Right.
You know, double X.
Well, there's a difference between, you know, different kinds of gender disorders, and I'm not really familiar with this, but, you know, from how you identify at one level, namely culturally, and there's another one at a biologic level and predispositions and how you act it out, and they're all different. And there is no clear – I mean, as I say, I reviewed this at some length, and I just said, wow, that's a fascinating and incomprehensible subject.
And this has been a fascinating and in many ways incomprehensible conversation. Always good to have you with us. Bob Burton's new book is A Skeptic's Guide to the Mind, What Neuroscience Can and Cannot Tell Us About Ourselves. He'll be at Coppersfields in Sebastopol at 7 o'clock on Tuesday, July 16th, to discuss the book. And you can continue this discussion by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. We thank you for being with us. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and an hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Larberg, and Susan Britton. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and executive producer is Raul Ramirez. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I thank you again for listening. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and the Sue Ann Gershenson Trust.